Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth lecture in the course Anarcho-Capitalism. This is the second time we've offered this course for Mises Academy. This is Lecture 5, Historical Applications, and today is August 29th, 2012. Now, let me, before we dive into today's lecture, let me just talk about something that was brought up in the office hours 4 session. All right, so if you're curious about this, I talked about it at some length. I think it was the last main thing we talked about. So again, these office hours things are purely voluntary. You won't be tested on them or anything. But if you're not in the habit of listening to them, you may, if you like this thing that I'm just going to give you a little quick summary of, you might want to go dig up the Office Hours 4 session and check that out. So what happened is somebody had asked me, he said, look, you mentioned this idea of economic ostracism or boycotting, however you want to describe it, is one way that a free society could deal with lawbreakers, right? And things like, you know, you said that, talking to me, that maybe the power company could cut off service or the internet provider could cut off service and so on. He said, but how would that be enforced? You know, why would it be in the interest of somebody to not trade with a lawbreaker? Was I assuming some other thing, like that there would be other forms of ostracism to maintain this united front and so on? So let me just clarify that. So there's two different levels. And so the person was totally right. I didn't get into this distinction, didn't talk about this back during the private law lectures. I kind of just threw it out there like it was no big deal and moved on. And the person's right. I should have clarified a little bit. So let me just give you a quick idea of what's involved. So on the one hand, a lot of it would just be pure self-interest on the part of the potential traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, meaning people who might trade with somebody. So some guy gets convicted of being either a bank robber or, you know, someone who habitually breaks contracts, someone who engages in serious fraud, commercial fraud with others, bilks them out of lots of money and so forth, or just a murderer, right? Or somebody who goes into bars and takes out a switchblade and starts stabbing people and they get in an argument with them. Right? Somebody who's convicted in a reputable court of these types of charges and then just doesn't do anything about it, and he just says, well, I don't agree with that court, or you're wrong, or just, you know, if he's a really tough guy, so yeah, I did that stuff. What are we going to do about it? I'm not paying any penalties, right? So remember, in my view, what the judge would do is say, okay, I think that this guy is guilty. You know, my application of the relevant body of law to these allegations, the plaintiff has brought this charge against this guy, and either he didn't show up to defend himself or he did, and it was an open and shut case, whatever. He's guilty. He did break the law, according to my understanding, and I think, in terms of what remedies does the law suggest, he owes this plaintiff 10 ounces of gold restitution. And that's the way he would get square with the law. So right now, there's this like legal debt hanging over his head. Maybe he doesn't have insurance, that kind of stuff. And so right now, this victim has not been made whole. He owes 10 ounces of gold, and until he pays it off, he is an outlaw. And this guy says, I'm not paying that, and he just walks out. All right, so the guy's employer, I mean, depending on the nature of the crime, I'm claiming there's a lot of things that would just kick in automatically in the sense that you wouldn't need to plead with or to bargain with everybody else to get them to do these sorts of things. So if he's been convicted of, like, being violent, well, then his employer probably isn't going to want him coming back onto the premises. And a grocery store isn't going to want him on the property. certainly, you know, some child care facility is not going to let him drop his kid off there because they don't want him in the building. The other parents would freak out if some convicted violent criminal is allowed to come and go in a place that's watching their kids, right? So, and the thing with the employer, it's not merely, you might think, well, depending on the kind of job, I mean, maybe it's not a big deal. It's not just that the employer running the numbers and thinking, well, yeah, when he drinks, he gets violent, but as long as he's not drunk when he shows up to work, you know, he knows how to run the drill press, it'd probably be okay. It's not just that. It's also other employees, when they're considering whether to work for that company or not, if they know the company really doesn't have a problem with having violent, convicted criminals who are just ignoring the judge coming and going during work, that's going to affect the type of people who want to work for you, right? So it's not merely them running the numbers and thinking, what kind of crime did he do? He's probably not going to steal any of our stuff. He's not that stupid. You see what I'm saying? So just, there are plenty of places that in their own immediate self-interest, with no issue about them thinking about the greater good or, you know, the principles of morality or anything, would severely restrict the way they would deal with that guy. And so that would happen immediately. Now, what's not as obvious is what about sort of boycotting him, so boycotting the convicted criminal. In a way that hurts the boycotter. Okay, so there, this one's not as obvious. So you can imagine stuff like the power company actually, you know, and again, I had just been throwing those examples out to try to show, look at the power that you could bring to bear on somebody just in terms of withholding voluntary transactions. So let me just make sure you guys are getting the big context here. The reason I personally am so enamored with these types of responses or retaliations or whatever you want to call it against the lawbreaker is that there's no question that this is within our rights as the community to do this kind of stuff. Whereas when you say, well, what if somebody's been convicted of a violent offense? Can we send guys with guns into his house and drag him out and put him in a cage, or can we kill him? You know, there it's not as obvious what you're allowed to do to somebody if you adhere to some form of rights theory, whether you think it's from God or just the nature of man, or if you're just a utilitarian. The point is, whatever the system is, it's one thing to spell out what the rights are in a just world if everyone obey these principles that we're spinning out, but then it's another thing to say, ooh, but what if somebody violates these principles we're spinning out? Now what can we do to that person? It's clearly, well, not clearly, but a lot of people think you're able to do stuff to somebody who violates the rights that you believe in that you wouldn't be able to do the person if he had respected everyone's rights. Okay, so you know, the default rule, Murray Rothbard would say, oh, of course you can't go grab someone and put them in a cage, or of course you can't just walk up to somebody and shoot them. But if that person is trying to shoot you, well, then you can shoot them. You see, and Rothbard doesn't think you just violated his rights. All right, so clearly there's some, what we're talking about is punishment theory. So what I'm saying is we can sidestep a lot of that stuff and be comfortable that a free society would work and be able to contain criminals even without getting into those thorny issues. If I can just show you, oh, look at how much incentive or pressure would be brought to bear on somebody if we just withhold voluntary transactions. Because clearly, I have the right to not sell someone electricity. If I'm the power company in an anarcho-capitalist society, I don't have a duty to sell electricity to anybody. I don't have to. And so if I wanted to and somebody is a convicted serial killer and we're not sure what we're allowed to do to the guy, and he's just up on his hill, you know, living in his cottage somewhere, I certainly have the legal right. I'm not violating libertarian principles by saying, you know what, I don't like that guy. I'm not selling him kilowatt hours anymore in exchange for his gold. I can do that. Okay, so the question, though, is now that you see the strategy and why I like this kind of thought process. The issue is, in a free market, is it plausible to think that that would happen? Because there's going to be competition, and so the only way that would really work is if a sufficiently large number of people felt that way. Because, you know, obviously somebody running a grocery store with parents coming with little kids pushing around the stroller, they're not going to want a serial killer looking for tomatoes and getting sliced bread also. They don't want him in the store. So, you know, his business certainly means nothing to them in the grand scheme of things for the publicity of the bad publicity of, you know, the competitors at that grocery store advertising, by the way, do you know this store lets convicted serial killers just walk around? You see what I'm saying? So clearly it's in that store's interest, it would maximize profits to not let such a person into the building. But if you're a power company and you have a nuclear reactor or you got a turbine set up near a waterfall or whatever, and you generate electricity and you've already got the infrastructure in place, and there's some guy in a cottage and he online pays you every month, but you know, he's not going to take his axe and hurt the transformer on his property. Or if he does, I mean, it's the thing's already sitting there. You've already spent the money to build it, right? So on the margin, why wouldn't you continue to sell him electricity? There's no way he can hurt you. The worst he can do is stop paying his bill, in which case you shut him off anyway, right? So the fact that he's a convicted serial killer, what do you care? So in those sorts of cases, I do think, so it's not as obvious what would happen, but I do think customs would emerge and it would be sort of expected that all upstanding people refrain from dealing with such a person. All right, and so, but here I'm just speculating and we can just think through how it would work out. If you really wanted to get into it, there's a neat literature, if you like to really think these things through. It's called, the topic is the finitely repeated prisoner's dilemma. Okay, so I studied this when I was in grad school. I was at NYU and I had to take some sort of mathematical economics courses just to get my degree and everything to prove that I knew what I was doing. And this issue fascinated me because I saw the relevance that if you wanted to do a sort of journal type article talking about private law and things like that and the stability of these outcomes, you could, if you wanted to, put some bells and whistles on it with this stuff. So I don't want to get bogged down. This obviously is very far afield here, but the idea is, you guys know what a prisoner's dilemma is. It's a situation, a strategic situation where everybody, if they act in his or her immediate self-interest, you end up with an outcome that makes everybody worse off. And so if you could only somehow get everybody to do the thing that renounces the immediate possible gain, then everybody is better off. And so that's kind of like saying, imagine you're in a world, we, the lawful people, would all be better off if we could all agree, let's ostracize anybody who gets convicted of a crime and doesn't obey the legal penalty. You know, if we could live in such a world, if we could all agree that, yes, we are going to be hardcore, and if somebody is convicted of a crime and then doesn't pay the penalty that the judge says, we're just going to refuse to trade with that person. If we could all, every last one of us who's a law-abiding citizen, do that and commit to that rule, we would have an amazingly peaceful, prosperous society, because any lawbreaker would quickly be brought to heel. But if people cheat and people realize, oh, come on, if I can sell this guy food, you know, I can ship him food through the mail and the delivery company's okay driving up and dropping it off and is driving away, not dealing with the guy, and then he pays them online or something, and the online companies realize, well, he can't hurt us by using our online payment system, so why not take his money, right? So everyone starts cheating a little bit. Well, now it becomes feasible to be a criminal, and so more people will be criminals, okay? So that's the idea. So the game theorists do these models, and they show that if you have, so in a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, it's not rational to get the good outcome. Everyone does the rational thing and they end up worse off. But if you repeat the thing, then the issue is, it might have to be infinitely too. There's different versions, if it's finite or infinitely. All right, so I'm putting an I in parentheses because there's different outcomes. If you repeat the thing, though, and then you have punishment strategies, you get a lot of interesting outcomes. Right? So I'm not going to, just very quickly, the idea is what can happen if you have these long-term strategies where you say, because what you want to do is you want to make it in your immediate self-interest to do the right thing and punish the guy, even though that hurts you. And so the way you do that is you have these complex rules, these strategies that say stuff like, okay, in round one, if somebody acts antisocially, so in the language of game theory, if somebody defects in the prisoner's dilemma in that first round, in round two, we all have to punish that guy. You know, we have to do something that really hurts us, but hurts him too. So that he, in round one, looks ahead and realizes that's our strategy, and, oh, I don't want to do the short-term thing right now where I cheat, because then they're going to punish me in round two. And then, but you say, but why would they do that in round two? Because that's not, it's not a credible threat, is the term. Well, the reason they would do it is because in round three, everyone's strategy says, if anybody in round two didn't punish somebody who cheated in round one, now in round three, we punish that guy. Right? So in round two, if someone has cheated in round one, all the law-abiding people, it's in their immediate rational interest to punish the lawbreaker because they know if they don't, the hammer's coming down on them in response. Okay, so removing it from formal game theory, just in plain English, the idea is you can imagine a society where you have these complex customs, and perhaps they're even contractually spelled out, like maybe you actually signed on to some agreement with all your neighbors that says stuff like, if anybody's convicted of murder, according to these reputable judges, blah, 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 and has had his chance for appeal and everything. So you want to make sure you're not dropping a hammer on somebody who might be innocent, but if this person's clearly a lawbreaker and beyond a reasonable doubt and he's used all legal remedies or whatever, or he's just flouting the system, what have you, we're not going to deal with this guy. And then if we catch anybody dealing with this guy, well, then you're going to get ostracized also. And maybe there could be different degrees of it. Like maybe you still sell food and stuff to the people, but you don't, promote them or whatever. You don't invite them to your dinner party. Maybe it's more of a social thing. Who knows? But the point is, in the way you can kind of make the thing actually enforceable and make it a credible threat is that you say, you know, all the law-abiding people say, we're going to abide by this ostracism rule, and if we catch people breaking it, then we punish you too. And so it's all reinforcing, and that's what makes it a credible threat. That's the deal. Incidentally, there was a really cool Twilight Zone episode about this. Not like the old school black and white with Rod Serling, but one of the newer ones that they made, new series. And the premise is it's this futuristic society, and they don't have jails or anything. It's just if you get convicted of a crime, then nobody talks to you. Or like whatever the length, so the more severe the crime, the longer it is, that people just don't even acknowledge your existence. And the way they enforce that, there's like these floating orbs or something in the sky that monitor everybody. If anyone does break down and out of compassion or whatever starts talking to someone who's been convicted, then that person now just committed a crime and everyone ignores that person. And so the point of this episode was to show if people really did this, it would be pretty awful, and people would think twice before committing a crime, because it's one thing to get thrown in jail, it's another thing to have just everyone literally ignore you like you're not even there. Like, that would drive you nuts. So anyway, that was a cool thing, showing this possibility. Okay, let me move on, and people are asking great questions in the chat box here about how would you denote this? It's kind of like the scarlet letter and that kind of, and so yes, and I think what's funny, let me just say one more comment on this before moving on. What's funny is when I bring this up, and I really love all this stuff because, as many of you know, I personally am a pacifist for religious reasons, but just intellectually and as an economist, I like thinking through this stuff just to show, just as a thought experiment, would a society be able to get by without having a line of work where your job was to go around and beat the heck out of people, right? That, you know, every Rothbardian thinks the state shouldn't be in charge of punishing lawbreakers, but many Rothbardians believe there does need to be a profession where your job title is you're a tough guy and you go beat the crap out of people. And so I'm saying maybe there doesn't need to be such a person in society. And so can we even imagine how such a society would get along? And so that's why I like thinking through these things. But what's interesting is when I bring up, because I used to get in these debates all the time when I was in grad school, bringing up this possibility of ostracism, I would get two types of responses. On the one hand, I would get people saying, that wouldn't work, that would never be enough, you'd get overrun by, you know, the mafia, or someone start an army, or someone would form a new government, and you refusing to sell him Campbell's soup isn't going to stop the guy. Okay, that's fine. But then I would get another type of objection from standard Rothbardians who believed in competing defense agencies that would have guys with guns going around and enforcing property rights. And they said, no, Murphy, your world is horrible. That I wouldn't want to live in a society where we just refuse to sell the people. Like, I'd rather, in other words, that made them squeamish. They thought that was too draconian of a penalty. And it worried them that we were thinking along those lines, because it seemed like that minorities wouldn't be protected. Like, what if all of a sudden just people didn't like somebody because of his religious views and they just refused to sell food to him? They didn't even want to think about that. So it was just funny that some people were thinking ostracism was too wimpy and other people were horrified that they didn't even want to start going down that path because it freaked them out. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about what the point of us going over these historical readings is. So that's what I'm calling framing issues. Okay, so first of all, Mises has a book, Theory and History, and if you want more about this, David Gordon has lectures at Mises University. All right, so I'm just going to give you a little tidbit here tonight, but if you're curious about this and want to go see more and see it from a sort of philosophical, methodological explanation, just go to the various Mises U archives at Mises.org and look up one of David Gordon's talks on this, because he gives this every year, and the title is Theory and History. Roderick Long may have given it once or twice too, but I know David Gordon has. So anyway, what Mises does in this book is he explains the relationship between theory and history, and he's primarily meaning it as an economist. And so, and there's different terms that Mises uses. So as you know, or many of you know, Mises as an economist is big on what's called praxeology and action, meaning purposeful behavior, so that when we as social scientists are interpreting somebody's, so some scene, and we're classifying it as action, if we think that there is an intelligence involved and there's some conscious will that has goals in mind, is trying to achieve an end and is using means to achieve them. So that's what Mises means by the term action in his famous book, Human Action. And that's what praxeology studies. In case you guys don't know that term, so praxeology, that's the science of human action. So Mises thinks that economics is a subset of the broader discipline of praxeology, which is the logical deductions that you can draw from the fact that there is human action. All right, so that's what pure economic theory is to Mises. So you don't test economic theory. Again, this is all according to Mises. This obviously is not the way mainstream economists think about things. All right, so that's not, so it's completely different from the natural sciences, where yes, you do go out and test proposed laws of physics or laws of chemistry. That's the way it works there, that you come up with conjectures and then you go and run experiments, if you can, to see how much does the experimental data conform to the predictions implied by our tentative laws. And if they look like they're pretty good and you do it in all sorts of different settings and tweak things, blah, 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 after a while you might say, we think this is a law of nature. Whereas economic laws, the way Mises conceives of them, rather than looking to physics or chemistry as the role model, instead, for him, a better analogy would be geometry. So in geometry, what do? You start out with axioms or definitions, like what do we mean by a point, what do we mean by a line, what's an angle, that kind of stuff. What does it mean for two lines to be parallel? And then you start proving things. You have little proofs. And what is a proof? Well, you start with some axioms, and then you have rules of what you can do with various results, and you transform them, and step by step you keep deriving further true propositions. So as long as the initial axioms are true, and as long as you didn't make a mistake in your deductive reasoning, everything that continues to pop out is itself true. And then, you know, once you prove something, once you have a theorem under your belt, you can invoke it later on to get some other theorem, right? You don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. Once you prove a theorem, boom, that's true forever, assuming you didn't make a mistake. And then when you're doing some other proof, you can just cite that thing, that result, and just have that in your back pocket. And then, so that's how geometry and mathematics in general builds upon itself. All right, so if you're in school and your teacher shows you the Pythagorean theorem, what does she do? She certainly doesn't go around and give you a ruler and a compass and have you just start measuring real-world triangles and say, no, tell me if you notice any pattern about, you know, if it's a right triangle between the height and the width and the hypotenuse. She doesn't do that. She proves it on the board so that you can just see, oh, she just did it for an arbitrary right triangle, so that is true in general, assuming she didn't do something wrong in the proof and I didn't see any mistakes that popped out to my eye, right? So that's the way it works. And then what would be the point of you going around and measuring real-world triangles? Well, you would get an approximation, right? In practice, because technically when you go to draw a triangle, you know, I might say, oh, there's a right triangle, see? But even here, as I'm trying to draw it, you actually didn't draw a triangle. Well, I mean, it would be a triangle if I ignore this stuff. But that's actually not really a right triangle. I didn't draw that perfectly. If you got a magnifying lens and looked at that thing, that's not really a right angle, and so on. So, and those lines aren't actually perfectly straight, even if, and then, of course, too, you get into all kind of crazy stuff about what Einstein was talking about, and we don't live in a Euclidean world, blah, blah, blah. All right? So there's a sense in which the Pythagorean theorem isn't true if you go to look at it empirically, but there's a sense in which logically, you know, yeah, but it is true. And the crucial thing is it's useful. So that's the thing that a lot of times gets lost in these debates that people have about economics and Mises' methodology. That's why I love using geometry as the example. Yeah, you can have quibbles about, oh, but we don't live in a Euclidean world. We still teach Euclidean geometry to everybody who's coming up in school, or we should. I mean, kids can't spell at this point, but you get the idea. So that's what Mises thinks about economic theory, that we're teaching these principles to people, these laws or whatever you want to call them, economic concepts or insights, and they are true. I mean, just thinking through the nature of the concepts involved. Like once you think about what does utility mean, or what does it mean to have preferences, what do you mean by comparative advantage, what's the division of labor, you think through these things, the results just pop out. It's not that you have to go test to make sure that that's a valid idea or something like that. And then moreover, it shouldn't shock us that just this pure thought process could lead us to things that actually help us in the real world, because that happens in geometry and mathematics in general, right? You can, and there's a sense in which you can just sit in a corner and think, and you could dream up all of modern mathematics. And it's not that you need to go out and look at the real world and experiment in order to have fodder with which to then formulate mathematics. In a sense, it's all mental. But there's also a sense in which it sure seems like us doing this, these mental somersaults or whatever, actually helps us do stuff in the real world. It gives us more command over nature that we can think through mathematical proofs. And that's kind of a mind-blowing thing, and we don't have time to get into that. If we all go out to a bar later, maybe we'll sit around and pontificate. But the point is, that's certainly true. And Mises says that's what's going on with economics also. That don't disparage economics by saying, oh, you Austrians just think it's all thought experiments and all you're doing is running around in circles with your definitions. You need to go out and look at the data, man. And Mises says, no, you're misconceiving the purpose of having a priori economic theory. Okay, but now what's the point of history? Well, there's a couple things. So Mises thinks that you can certainly go and apply economic theory to historical episodes. So if you're armed with Austrian business cycle theory in terms of the concepts and the logical deductions and what does it mean to talk about the market rate of interest and then what would happen if the banks expanded credit and pushed the market rate below pushed the actual rate below what the free market natural rate would have been, and you could talk about those sorts of things. But then it's something else to go look at a historical period and say, is this what's going on here? And another thing, too, so here, I don't know that Mises ever made this point. This is me talking now. You can have, as an economist, all these logically deduced conclusions and relationships and so on, and you can be sure that they're right, assuming you don't see any flaw in the logical deductive process. You don't have to test them to see if they're right. But what does take some judgment and some knowledge of the data, if you will, is to know which thing is the most relevant for a certain period. So, for example, one example I've been using lately, I happen to think, when I'm trying to understand why is it there was the big housing bubble and crash, and why did we have a huge crisis in 2008, and how come the economy still hasn't recovered, and how come it just seems like the economy's broken, to me, I look at the Federal Reserve and what's known as Austrian business cycle theory. That's my first go-to explanation for the lion's share of what the heck happened with the world economy and the U.S. economy from 2001 through today. But it's also true that in that period, there was the minimum wage law. And actually, they jacked up the minimum wage a few years ago. And so it's true that I think other things equal, raising the minimum wage would increase unemployment. And so if you look at the data, you see that. Oh, my gosh, they increased the minimum wage and the labor market's awful. But just my judgment looking at history and my sort of gut feeling about the relevance of various factors, I don't think right now the world economy is in such awful shape because they raised the minimum wage. All right, so does everyone get what I'm saying there? So it's not that, oh, we just had a test of the minimum wage law and I'm rejecting that. That's not the issue. Yes, unemployment right now is higher, especially among unskilled workers, than it otherwise would be because they raised the minimum wage law. But in the grand scheme, I don't think that's a big deal. I think it's the stuff the Fed's been doing. All right, so in a similar token, or by a similar token, then, that's what I'm viewing as the relevance of these historical episodes. We're not proving that anarcho-capitalist principles work by looking at these historical case studies. Rather, we're just trying to show that, in other words, all the things that I said in the private law and the private defense, you know, the general principles, the fact that competition is good, economic calculation makes sense even when it comes to military debt. Those principles are all true. I mean, we can just think through them logically as economists in terms of theory. But then we're also interested in broader questions like, are there other factors that might swamp those things? So it might be true to say that with competition among judicial scholars, there'd be more efficient discovery process, and maybe the law would be crisper or something, and there'd be less corruption among the judges than there is under a status system. But if for some reason you had a society of people that they really thought there needed to be a state that provided the rule of law, and if they didn't have that, then they would think, oh, this isn't real, and they'd go around looting and killing, well, it's conceivable then that for that group of people, anarchy wouldn't work. Right? It wouldn't mean that you just blew up the case for anarcho-capitalism, but it would just mean, well, in this particular weird case, there's some odd stuff going on. And those principles you talked about are still true, but they're getting trumped by other factors. Right? So that's, to me, the virtue of these historical case studies, is just you can see these general theoretical principles that we know are a force pushing in one direction. You can see that actually in practice in many places they were powerful enough to overcome whatever other sorts of things may have been going on. Okay, selection bias. I talked about this a lot in previous lectures. So again, here what the main thing I want you to remember is that a lot of stateless societies are war-torn. Or there's some other natural disaster or whatever. And that happens a lot. So the classic example of this would be Somalia, and we'll talk about that in particular in a couple minutes. But that's, so just be on guard for this, that it's, because it is true when you naturally dream up and say, okay, what are places that I know of that don't have a functioning government? You didn't just describe all the best places you'd ever want to live throughout history, even though we're thinking, I want to imagine a really great place that's possible in terms of the nature of human beings, I'm certainly thinking of a stateless place. But that's odd then, how come looking back through history, if we look at the sample of all stateless places, a lot of them look like hellholes, right? And it's because of this issue of selection bias, that how did they get to be stateless? It's because something awful happened. Okay, the Nirvana fallacy, I've talked about this before also, but just to recapitulate, for our purposes, if somebody says, oh, your stateless society's mechanisms, you're talking about private legal systems and Rothbardian defense agencies, and oh, the insurance company's going to hire firms to provide tank defenses, and they come up with all these scenarios to show you there would still be homicides, there would still be invasions. You can't guarantee me that your little country, or you wouldn't call it a country maybe, but your little group of freedom lovers would be invulnerable to the UN coming in and taking over. Well, right, but every day in the United States, which most of these people think of as a great bastion of limited government and law and order, there's police brutality, there's certainly crime, there's all kinds of crime statistics, and if you believe the official story, the United States government, despite the hundreds of billions that it spends on defense and intelligence services, got hit by 19 guys with box cutters. And they did an incredible amount of damage compared to all this money that the U.S. government allegedly spends to defend us. And the reason I say the official story is that what's odd is sometimes when I make that point, people will get mad at me and they'll say, oh, but that's not what happened. It, you know, it was an inside job. Okay, well, then that proves my point even more so, right? It hardly hurts the case for anarchy if I say, oh, because the state might actually stage a terrorist attack and blow up thousands of its own people in order to gain more power for itself. That makes the case for anarchy even stronger. So whether you think 9/11 happened the way the government said or whether you think it was an inside job, either way, 9/11 is a huge black eye on the case for the necessity for the state to provide military defense or defense from terrorists. Okay, so let's move on to the case studies. Now here, there's obviously, I'm not going to do a book report for you guys. If you want to read the stuff, you can read it. And if you don't have time to read it, I'm just going to summarize some of the key things. So let me, what I'm going to be doing mostly tonight as I whip through these case studies is telling you the things that I want you to be on the lookout for if you happen to go read them. And I also want to just summarize some of the main points because I know some of you are busy. You can tune in the lectures, but you don't have time to do the reading. So I want to at least talk about some of the salient points here. Okay, Somalia is my favorite example in terms of dealing with the apples to oranges way that people try to argue with you about anarchy. All right, what's the name of that thing? There's this pretty funny YouTube. So it was, I don't think it was in response to Ben Powell. Somebody else did a Mises.org talking about, it was like stateless in Somalia and loving it. Or so it was a, you know, Jeff Tucker probably picked the title or something. But it was a provocative title to get you to read the article. And it was talking about how Somalia was better after the fall of the brutal dictatorship than it was before. And so somebody spoofed that and did a YouTube. And it's like these two people go into a beach. If anyone knows what I'm talking about, can you put it in the link in the comments? And so it was like these people going to the beach, and then they were like, hey, what's up? We're going to the beach. And they see a sign saying public property. And they're like, oh, the government owns the beach? Oh, no. And then it says, wait a minute, kids, go to Somalia, libertarian paradise. And then they go to Somalia, and they're all dancing and stuff. And then at the end of the thing, it says, oh, and I have cholera. All right. And so in the notes to that YouTube, it says, we're not attacking a straw man. There are actually idiots running around, libertarian idiots, claiming Somalia is a cool place to live. And they give a link to this Mises.org article. All right. So it was a clever video or whatever. But the point is nobody, no Rothbardian is saying, hey, I want to move to Somalia. Somalia is awesome. The point is they're saying Somalia under anarchy is better than Somalia was under the state. So why was it in anarchy? And so the guy who's done a lot on this is Ben Powell. He's the I can't even write. Ben Powell, that's a W. So he's given some lectures. He had a scholarly peer-reviewed article with some co-authors. And then that Freeman summary that was not this week but the previous week's, week four, was in the readings for that in case you want to go look. It's a very quick read. If you're curious, just look at that and skim it. So the point was there was, I'm not going to know how to pronounce this guy's name, Siad Barr. I don't know how to pronounce his name. He was a military leader and had a military dictatorship. You know, he took over the Somali government and ran it with an iron fist, and then that fell in 91. All right, so he had run it for decades. His government collapsed in 91 because he was challenged. And then after his government fell, no faction was strong enough to establish a new government. So there was civil war, various factions competing with each other, trying to take over the reins of power. Now, what is really interesting, and it's a crucial point that I want you, by the way, I see someone's posting in the chat box there, the URL for that YouTube if you want to see it. But wait till after the lecture. You got to hear my awesome lecture first. This crucial point that Powell makes is that if you're looking at the violence in Somalia, and it's true, right after the government fell, what happened is what the standard critic of anarcho-capitalism warns us about. Once the powerful central government fell in Somalia, you had a bunch of competing warlords, you know, rulers from different clans, trying to take over, and they were fighting each other openly. So it looked like the nightmare scenario of, oh my gosh, that's anarchy. If you don't have a strong central state, that's what's going to happen. But Powell pointed out that when the UN pulled out in 95. When that happened, the violence went down. Now, this is curious, because there's a couple things going on here. So first of all, you guys know like the Black Hawk Down stuff and all that. It's interesting that Somalia, this, which is not known for its technological superiority and its huge standard of living, that Somalia was able to expel a bunch of UN troops, including like US, I don't know if they were Marines, but people that are professional killers hired by governments and trained by governments to go ahead and kick some tail. You know, these guys were expelled by the Somalis. They decided this is not worth our efforts, right? So that's when people talk about, oh, if you had some fledgling anarchist society, you would just get steamrolled by the U.S. or U.K. Keep in mind, the major governments of the world did try to reestablish a government in Somalia, and they failed, and they just decided it's not worth it. So if the Somalis can kick out foreigners, imagine what the Texans could do, if the Texans all of a sudden tomorrow became all anarcho-capitalists with their advanced standard of living and weaponry and whatever. All right, so that's one thing. But the crucial point that Powell points out here is that the violence among the regional warlords dropped off dramatically once the UN pulled out. Now, why is that the case? Well, we don't know for sure because we can't do a controlled experiment, but Powell's interpretation is that the reason these warlords were fighting each other so dramatically and bitterly is that they had seen how awful it was to be on the losing end of the powerful government under the military dictatorship that fell in 91. And so there was this tremendous government apparatus that had been installed and then systematically exploited people and looted everybody for the benefit of the insiders, the elites who are running the government and their allies. And so when the UN was coming in and trying to reestablish that very system and just handpick the tribal chieftain or the clan leader, whatever the, I don't know what the nomenclature would be, when the UN was trying to come in and reestablish a government that the UN could deal with, the other people who realized, whoa, if you pick that warlord and make him in charge of the government, well, we've had disputes with him going back 200 years. That's going to be awful. We don't want this new central state with an army and everything backed up by the UN and money from the UN and weapons from the US or whatever being turned against us. So heck no, we're not letting you guys take over. We're going to fight to the death before we see you get installed as the new rulers. But once the UN pulled out and there wasn't this threat of an official recognized Somali government that was, you know, had diplomatic relations and got foreign aid and stuff from the UN and the World Bank or whatever, well then now if it's just among us Somalis, well it's not as big a deal because no one faction is strong enough to take over. And we're not all gonna bow down and give you tribute and everything. If you tried to take over, we would all collectively team up and oust you like we just did to the last guy. And so now the threat's not as severe, so now we can back off and we don't have to keep killing each other. Whereas if it looks like somebody's really close to getting installed with UN backing and they've got, you know, Black Hawk helicopters coming in and stuff backing up these, you know, whoever the winner's going to be, well, then you're going to fight to the death because that's an awful system. You don't want to let that happen, right? So it's the exact opposite of what we're taught to think, that the UN peacekeepers come in and pacify a region and install a legitimate government so we can get law and order. It's the other way around, that because the UN was meddling and trying to install a government, the people were freaking out because they'd seen firsthand what the legitimate Somali government does to them. And they would rather die than have that thing get established. Right? So that's the single most important thing. Well, not the single, that's a crucial lesson from that. The other thing is he's got some statistics. So he had, and this is what they did in their peer-reviewed journal article, they had 13 different objective measures of well-being, you know, things like literacy, I think, and, you know, malnutrition rates and infant mortality, stuff like that. And they were just comparing, looking at various comparisons. So, for example, looking at Somalia in the X number of years before the government fell compared to Y number of years after the government fell. and then looking at these measures and the before and after to try to isolate what was the effect of having a state versus having anarchy. And then they also looked at Somalia in the with a state and without a state compared to its peers. In other words, looking at dozens of other African nations. Because again, the point isn't, do you want to go live in Somalia when it's stateless? The point is, if you have to live in an African country, do you want to live in a stateless one, or do you want to live in one with a state? And then the question's not as obvious as far as how you want to answer that. So yeah, the U.S. or Canada with a state is more pleasant than Somalia without a state, but it's not as clear, is Somalia without a state better or worse than one of its neighboring countries with a state? Okay, one, just to give you one example, again, if you want to see the actual numbers, because it's kind of nuanced, it's hard for me to summarize, but one thing that really jumped out at me that I'll reproduce here in case you just don't have time to read it, is they found that from 1985 to 1990, the life expectancy in Somalia went down by 2 years. So it was already low to begin with compared to the United States or whatever. But the point is, it went down 2 years over that 5-year period. So notice the guy fell in 91. So this is looking at the 5 years of the Somali state before it finally crumbled. And then they point out that from 91 to the present, now, I don't know when their actual data stopped. So the article was in 2009, but I don't know how, you know, there's usually a lag with that kind of stuff, especially from Africa. So I don't know when his life expectancy data for Somalia stopped. But the point is, from 1991 till whenever that last date was, probably 2006 would be my guess, the life expectancy was up by 5 years. Again, it's not that life expectancy in Somalia in 2006 was something to brag about, but the point is the trend was certainly better. The trend was going down in the last years of this guy's military dictatorship, and then after that fell and they had true anarchy, life expectancy rose. So on that narrow criterion, you would say anarchy in Somalia was better than the state. Okay, let's move on here because we've got a lot of material still to cover. Pennsylvania, here, this was the Rothbard article, partly because he had a lot of information, but also because it's Rothbard, I don't think I need to point out the lessons that we need to derive from. In other words, Rothbard is the person best equipped to go through the historical material and say, now from a Rothbardian perspective, that's why this is interesting, right? I'm not going to out Rothbard. Let me just mention, again, in case you guys aren't going to have time to even look at the thing, what he's talking about is William Penn and the colony he sets up and how it has various periods of pseudo-anarchy and then how the crown comes in and tries to put taxes in place and that kind of stuff. But one of the things he mentions is that early on, the Quakers had peace with the American Indians. And he quotes, I think it was Voltaire, he quotes Voltaire saying something like, this was the one time when people from Europe went over and signed treaties with the American Indians that they actually obeyed, meaning the Europeans. All right, so that's kind of interesting that in terms of law and order and respecting contracts and stuff that Rothbard just mentioned, and whether you could expect to have peace or violence without a strong government, that Rothbard's showing this period that you could somewhat described as anarchy or an experiment in anarchism with more or less validity was characterized by relative peace among the settlers and the American Indians who had lived there originally. Whereas Andrew Jackson, bless his heart on fiscal matters, certainly was not peaceful in the U.S. government dealing with American Indians, and certainly plenty of other officials from the new United States government were also pretty brutal in how they dealt with the American Indians. So again, there's this tendency, and I even fall into the trap too. There's this tendency when we're thinking about anarchy versus the state, we think about just day-to-day living under a state, and we don't think about things like major wars or major events that are sort of out of the ordinary. So, for example, if you're wondering about, well, gee, how would minority groups be treated, like under a private legal system, you could worry, oh, well, what if there's some group that just the general community doesn't trust? And how can you guarantee me, Murphy, that the legal system will treat them fairly? And maybe if there's some crimes occurring, maybe everyone's going to say, oh, it's the gypsies, or oh, it's the Jews, or oh, it's the whoever, and they're going to lock them up. And yeah, I can't guarantee that won't happen. I can talk about the market incentives that would be in place, the market forces that would try to minimize that sort of thing. Given people's preferences, we can talk about what the likely outcome would be. But yeah, I can't guarantee that. And then, so the critic who raises that objection has in mind everyday run-of-the-mill stuff in the U.S. system, especially if they're a little bit naive and don't know about the different ways that the criminal justice system, you know, cracks down on cocaine users as opposed to crack users. And they might think, yeah, see, we have the rule of law here, and everyone's treated fairly. But they don't think, okay, what about World War II when the Japanese Americans were interred, right? I mean, when you say to the average American that the phrase concentration camp, they think of Nazi Germany. They don't think of FDR ordering people to be locked up because of their ethnicity and because everyone was scared because it was the middle of the war and, well, the beginning of the war, and all of a sudden they were afraid of Japanese people, right? So it's just, again, keep that in mind. Or when you're worried about, oh, well, how would an anarchist system protect us from foreign bombers and things like that? Whatever your arguments are, don't just think of the United States in the middle of the afternoon on a Tuesday. Also realize that Germany had a strong state, and its cities got the heck bombed out of them. And that was because they had a strong state that was trying to conquer its neighbors, and that's why all hell got unleashed on them, right? So it doesn't at all follow. You got to be careful, and you got to take the state in all of its wonder, in other words. That keep in mind, if you're going to have a strong state that can protect you from foreign bombers, that strong state might also get aggressive and try to invade other people and then invite a retaliation on you. Okay, Iceland. This was the David Friedman excerpt. Incidentally, just so you guys know, this is his essays here are pretty famous in anarcho-capitalist circles. To the point that when people want to make fun of anarcho-capitalists, they'll say stuff like, I mean, unless we go back to ancient Iceland, you guys don't even have any examples. Right, so that's, on the one hand, a compliment and an insult to David Friedman, who's Milton Friedman's son, in case you guys don't know that, that for many people, this is considered to be the best case study. And Friedman himself opens up, so he's talking about it's ancient Iceland in the 10th through the 13th centuries. And they rely on, his primary sources are these sagas, and like that's the, I think it was like originally an oral tradition recording all these things, and then it got written down. So that's how we know about this stuff and the way that their legal system worked and so on. And so Friedman says something like, it's almost like these Icelandic tales were concocted by a mad economist who wanted to see the limits of decentralized, market-driven, polycentric legal systems. And so let me just mention the hero of the most famous saga, and again, I have no idea how to pronounce this stuff, N-J-A-L, and he wasn't a hero because he was a warrior, right? It wasn't like he was Achilles, nor was he sort of the crafty fighter like Odysseus. The reason he is the hero, and again, the most famous of these sagas, and I'm just quoting here, so I think this is a quote from the saga. This isn't just Friedman talking. He himself is making a quote saying that this guy was so skilled in law that no one was considered his equal. All right, so that's kind of interesting that he's held up because he is a jurist. What they had, one of the important things in this system was the Wehrgeld, W-E-R-G-E-L-D. Let me write that again. That didn't come out very well. Which you could think of as a man price. And the idea is if you killed somebody, it wasn't that the authorities came and put you in jail, because there was a sense in which there really weren't authorities in that respect, but you owed money to the appropriate party. So it was like you got fined. It was like, so instead of it being this horrible criminal offense, it was more analogous to a speeding ticket. And the interesting thing is that Friedman recounts this part where these groups are like in the courtroom and they're getting ready to start throwing down with each other. Like things are getting, tempers are flaring, people are getting ready, they're burnishing their axes or whatever, and they're getting ready to start fighting. And then one of the hostile parties says to a neutral party something like, hey, if we start throwing down with these guys, whose side are you going to be on? And the guy responds saying, well, if you guys are losing the fight, I'm going to help you, presumably because I think you're in the right on this dispute. But if you're winning, I'm going to intervene and urge you to stop fighting because I'm going to be afraid that you'll end up incurring too much financial cost that you won't be able to afford. All right. So the point is he's saying that, yeah, I agree with you, but, and so that's why if you're losing the fight, I'll jump in and help you. But if you just start whipping these guys, then I'm going to come in and try to get you to stop fighting because I wouldn't want to see you in the heat of battle end up racking up such a bill for yourself that you'd be bankrupt. Okay, so the point is, even as you're slaughtering people in this fight in which I think you have the moral legitimacy that you're in the right in this dispute, still, you got to pay the Wehrgeld, right? I mean, you can't, if you kill somebody, you got to pay the next of kin or whatever, and I wouldn't want to see you. So the point is, since they're winning the fight, meaning they're probably killing a lot more of those other people than vice versa. Okay, so that's just Friedman highlights that passage because he said that's pretty amazing. That's not something that you see in other forms of other literature so much. You know, it's not like here I'm talking, this isn't Friedman talking. But you read the Old Testament, for example, and it's not that Joshua goes out and spies the land promised by the Lord and comes back, and the other spies come back and report to the people and say, oh yeah, we could take them, but we end up killing so many, we're not sure if we'd be able to afford it. I mean, that's not even an issue. The issue is just, can we take these guys or not? You never think, it's almost like by definition, if you win the fight, you don't owe anybody any money, you won. What are they going to do to you? But here, it's just such a principle that you have to pay for the people you kill, that's just ingrained, and that's the way they think, and that even affects their military strategy. So anyway, that's a really neat aspect of that. Okay, let me move on here. I really think I'm going to have time for your questions at the end of this one. Okay, the American Wild West. So here the article is the Not-So-Wild West, an American experiment in anarcho-capitalism. Let me just say, if you just read one of these things that I've assigned, I think this is the best one to read. That for me personally, when I, on my intellectual development, I had, of course, primarily because of Rothbard, eventually become an intellectual anarchist in the sense that I thought theoretically it made sense, and ethically, of course, it made sense and all that stuff. But in terms of me in my bones thinking, would this actually work? It was this article that really reassured me and made me genuinely start to believe that, yeah, if you had people with typical American values who were raised in the sort of culture that I identify with, and then they were thrust into a situation that wasn't a calamity, but that lacked a formal government, that they wouldn't just start shooting each other. That they would come with orderly procedures that weren't grossly unfair, and that didn't just favor the strong. And this article, more than any other, reassured me personally that that would be the case. Also, if you do go to read it and you're pressed for time, in the beginning they have a lot of a preamble with just setting the context and placing their results or their study in the context of public choice theory and the literature on anarcho-capitalism. So you can kind of flip through that if you're pressed for time and just want to get right into the case studies. So, where did I put my, sorry. Here it is. Let me just make a few notes here for you guys. So the period they're looking at is 1830 to 1900, excuse me. And they list six propositions that they're going to, so six claims that the anarcho-capitalists make in the literature that they're going to say our case studies shed light on. So let me just read what these propositions are. So the first one is, anarcho-capitalism is not chaos. Property rights will be protected and civil order will prevail. The second one is that private agencies will provide the necessary functions for preservation of an orderly society. The third is that private protection agencies will find that warfare is costly, so they won't engage in it very often. The fourth is that the concept of justice is something that varies because individuals have different preferences, and so there's not just a single good justice, but in fact, it's something that that has to be provided for on the margin, and some people might want more of it and some less. The fifth is that there are not significant enough economies of scale in crime so that major mafia organizations evolve and dominate. And the sixth is that there's competition among protected agencies, and that this will serve as healthy checks on undesirable behavior. So those are the six claims that they say you find throughout the anarcho-capitalist literature that's theoretical. And so then they say, okay, we now went and looked through the historical evidence from this period of the American West from 1830 to 1900, and we found support for these propositions. And so that's what they're doing here. That's how they view what they're doing. Okay. Let me read just a little bit more, and then I'll just outline what they do. So as far as the title, you know, the Not-So-Wild West, why, what's their main result here? That's a misnomer. That's because of Hollywood, and it's just more dramatic. It's more fun to read novels about gunslingers and stuff that paint a picture of the Wild West where you go into the saloon and someone cheats you at cards and you go and do that, blah, blah, blah. And but they're saying, actually, that's very misleading. So W. Eugene Holland stated that, quote, the Western frontier was a far more civilized, more peaceful, and safer place than American society is today. The legend of the Wild Wild West lives on. Da, 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 da. Okay, so here's some statistics. So Robert Dykstra found that in five of the major cattle towns, which is Abilene, Ellsworth, Wichita, Dodge City, and Caldwell, for the years 1870 to 1885, only 45 homicides were reported. So again, that's five major cattle towns, and you've heard of Dodge City if you watch, you know, westerns and stuff. And so over a 15-year period from 1870 to 1885, a total of 45 homicides were reported. All right, so that's a pretty low number for five cities over 15 years, where these are cities we associate with being the lawless West, where the only law came from the barrel of a gun, that kind of thing. In Abilene, supposedly one of the wildest of the cow towns, quote, nobody was killed in 1869 or 1870. In fact, nobody was killed until the advent of officers of the law employed to prevent killings, end quote. So they're quoting from some historian. Only two towns, Ellsworth in 1873 and Dodge City in 1876, ever had five killings in any one year. All right, so now off the top of my head, I don't know what the population was of these towns, so you could argue, well, per capita, that's actually a big, whatever. But the point is, if you ask the average American, Dodge City, how many murders do you think they had per, or homicide, do you think they had in a typical year, they probably would say a number in the double digits at least, right? Because in their mind, oh my gosh, it was anarchy. Somebody's drinking whiskey at the saloon, guy cheats him in cards, there's a gun battle next day. Okay, so they have four main categories of how private legal systems and law enforcement develops. So the first is land clubs. So this is where the point is settlers come into an area and they want to have the land, you know, build a house or whatever. And so the point is if there's no formal government out there because you're going out west, you're leaving civilization, you're just showing up on the frontier, and it's just other settlers like you, and you show up, hey, I want to go build a cabin over there by that stream, or I want to start cutting down these trees. Can I do that? Or am I stealing someone's property? So they needed these land clubs to define and allocate property titles to the actual land. And the interesting thing about that was that they mostly operated through ostracism. That was the way they enforced these things. So you're a newcomer and you show up, you kind of just go along with the flow, and they had an orderly set of procedures and constitutions and things like that to make things systematic and fair, objective. And if somebody showed up and just started violating the rules that everybody else had already been obeying, that one of the main punishments brought to bear against this person is just economic ostracism. Okay, they also talk about cattlemen's associations. All right, so what we're going to find in these four categories is just a different venue for why you need property rights, right? So if you need it in land, well, that's why the land clubs developed. Here, it was a different scenario where you had the property that you cared about was your herd, right? You had a bunch of cattle that you were moving around, and you wanted to make sure somebody wasn't poaching it from you, and then you had legitimate, honest disagreements where, you know, your cattle are intermingling with the other rancher's cattle, and they get mixed up, and how do you deal with, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas that, so this is a different kind of problem from you just want to settle somewhere, and there's these fixed geographical boundaries, and who owns what parcel of land. So you notice how this is a different thing if you're moving cattle from point A to point B. And so here is where, in contrast to ostracism, they had hired guns. Now, I don't remember in the article if they said this. It just occurs to me right now. Part of the reason for this difference might be just the fact that with the land clubs, you're going to go somewhere and stay there and just be there for years, and you have your neighbors. And so there it kind of makes sense why if somebody's being a jerk and violating the rules that everyone else is trying to follow, you just ignore that person and ostracize them, and that kind of brings in a bear. Whereas if you're moving your cattle and some guy that you never have seen before comes up and steals some of your cattle and then goes away and you never would see him again, well, ostracizing him is not going to be a big deal. So you've got to hire somebody to go shoot him, right, and take your cattle back by force. So that occurs to me is the nature of the type of property rights they're trying to enforce here as to why maybe these cattlemen's associations, these are the guys that had the hired guns that were so enamored with in Westerns. And what the authors here point out is that the hired guns, these professional killers, guys who were really good shots and were ruthless and weren't afraid to go kill people, they worked for the Cattlemen's Associations not because they cared about law and order, but because the Cattlemen's Associations paid them the most. And this is that's a really important point that I can't stress enough. And it comes up, if you guys have seen the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, there's kind of a funny scene in the beginning when they, you know, they keep holding up railroad cars, you know, or they'll stop the train and then rob the whole car and everything. And so the owners get really mad, and they spend a ton of money to get, like, this huge posse to go after them. I'm going to botch the line, but you know, Paul Newman, he says something funny like, I mean, if they would just pay me what they're paying these guys to stop me from robbing them, I wouldn't need to rob them. You know, so something like that, meaning that these guys are spending more to hire all these detectives and these sharpshooters from across the country to track me down when I'm actually stealing less from them on average than they have to pay these guys. So the point is, when you have a law-abiding society and you're worried about a few malcontents, a few criminals, I mean, the law-abiding society is going to have a lot more resources to bring to bear. They're going to be able to, so even if there are mercenaries who are just up for the highest bidder, the law-abiding people are going to have more money to pay them than the outlaws. So this idea that, oh no, what if these outlaw groups could just form and grow and have this huge thing and all the hired killers go work for them, then we can't stop them. How could that be? That couldn't happen. Because the 1% of criminals is not going to have more money than the 99% of law-abiding people. And so as long as the hired killers are willing to work for the law-abiding people when they get paid more, that's all you need. Right? So you have to posit the system where there's guys who like to shoot people and who like getting paid less by the criminals rather than getting a bigger paycheck from, you know, the sheriff or whatever. And it doesn't work. Okay. Next one was the mining camp. Mining camp. So here the idea is you show up and there's miners already there. They're, you know, prospecting. They're putting their, what do you call those things? Sieves in the water or whatever, and they're trying to see if there's silver and so forth. They're digging around. And there's got to be rules for who gets what and where can I go? If I'm a prospector too, you know, because there's people here before me, and they have nice rules there. And a lot of what they did, they talk about, is that a lot of people had rules before they left. So if you're in the East and you're hearing all these stories, there's a gold rush or a silver rush or whatever, and you want to go out, find your fortune, and you team up with some group of people that are heading out there, because you'd be suicidal to go by yourself. You got to go with a group of people and have a chance of making it. Well, before you leave civilization, you come up with some rules about how are we going to handle disputes, or what are we going to do if we get 1,000 miles west and such happens, what are we going to do? They have rules going into it. So there's a sense in which a lot of these rules were already voluntarily agreed upon. And then the issue is, well, what happens when you bump into other groups who had different rules from what you guys had? What do you do? And they settle things peacefully. Incidentally, it was that discussion that really made me personally start to believe that this stuff could work. We're reading about how the different claims of the miners and stuff was settled fairly peacefully. Okay, and then the last one were wagon trains. And again, similar thing. Just notice there are different situations, different types of property rights that are necessary for these different environments. And they're just talking about how the laws were developed in these different scenarios. All right, because of time constraints, let me just move on to the last slide. Okay, one example that you'll often hear, and I put in Walter Block's picture here because he loves to make this point, is when he's trying to make the case that anarchy works and that the objections of the critics are wrong and that we don't need to fear there'd be rampant lawlessness and violence and so on in a stateless world, Walter Block will often say, I mean, look at planet Earth. We don't have one world government. There's anarchy between the different countries, and yet they trade with each other and blah, blah, blah. I mean, yes and no. I actually don't stress that one, though, for a couple reasons. On the one hand, there are plenty of wars, right? So it's a bit weird, like, to point at World War II, those years, and say, see, the world under anarchy, just once in a while, hundreds of millions of people get slaughtered, and there's nuclear bombs or atomic bombs that go off. But other than that, it's pretty peaceful. You see what I'm saying? That, and, of course, you know, Block would say, oh, but that's not the fault of anarchy. That's because there's governments. But I'm saying his point was we can see the benefits of anarchy by looking at planet Earth where there's not one government over everything. So I just think it's kind of a weird point to make because the world is kind of crappy right now in many respects. And there's lots of people that are on the verge of starvation and so on. So it seems weird to me to point to Earth as an example of the wonders of anarchy. Because by the same token, it would be weird to me to say if you want to see anarchy in action, I mean, just look at the United States right now, where yeah, there's a strong federal government, but there's also different things going on in the states, and the states can have different jurisdictions and things, and you could go back to a time when the federal government was weaker, and I wouldn't want to call that anarcho-capitalism either. So anyway. Just my own little view on that particular example, that I personally don't go down that route because I think it's not self-evident that that's really a great example of how anarchy would work. Okay, we've got some time here, 7 minutes. Let me turn to your questions. Lewis says, in the office hours on that subject, you said that everybody should sign a contract stipulating that you cannot engage in exchange with convicted criminals, but I did not understand why you had to use a contract instead of relying on the market to make a law that controls this fact, with plaintiffs going to the arbiter to tell they are breaking this law. If I'm understanding you, Lewis, so what I was saying in the office hours is that, first of all, I was acknowledging, and I'm sorry, I forget who asked me the question about the ostracism. So that's what he's getting at here, is this issue of ostracism. That, yes, for ostracism to be fully effective, you would want people to refrain from transactions with convicted lawbreakers, even though it was hurting them, the person doing the boycott. So that actually they think, I could probably trade with this guy and I'm not going to get burned. You know, even though he's a convicted criminal, the nature of our dealings with each other, I actually still would benefit, you know, if I just consider things selfishly from my point of view. And so I'm saying for ostracism to be truly effective and really be good at deterring criminal behavior so that potential criminals would look ahead and see, ooh, if I did all that, this is what would happen. Or if in the heat of the moment they do commit a crime and then they don't want to pay the penalty, they realize, oh, going through life with this kind of boycotting is worse than me just sucking it up and paying the guy the judge said I was supposed to pay. Right? So that's the issue too. So make sure everyone understands that. I'm not saying that the criminals are all so rational that this is going to deter them from committing the crime in the first place. I mean, even if you have been convicted, and even if there is no mechanism by which armed guys come and throw you in a cage, you're going through life and you can't ever fly on a plane, you can't ever go on a cruise ship, you can never set foot in a grocery store, no employer ever hires you. You know, you might just buckle down and say, okay, I'm just going to pay off the fine that judge says I owe the family of the people I killed, just because that's cheaper. It's less of a headache for me. Okay, so for that to be effective, that kind of institutional framework or arrangement, there has to be sort of a coordinated boycott because, yeah, the grocery store doesn't let you in, but you can just order your food online and somebody ships it to you, you know, ships you steaks. Because remember, this is an anarcho-capitalist society. People are going to be fantastically wealthy. then it's going to be tricky or it's not going to be as effective. So what I was saying, Lewis, is that you probably would want to systematize these arrangements if that really was the way society was going to deal with these people. You wouldn't need it if you had an official mechanism of professional force-wielding personnel that would show up and grab you and take you to a prison. But if you didn't have that and you wanted to really rely on boycotting, you would probably want to systematize it. So what I was saying in the office hours is you might even sign official contracts so everyone's crystal clear on, you know, because there could be things like what if you're a religious group and you think that, no, no matter what someone does, he shouldn't starve to death. And so maybe you provide bread and soup to anybody. You don't care what they did, and that's part of your religious ministry or something. Well, then you might say, I'm not signing any pledge promising not to do that. And so in the contracts or whatever might make due allowance for that stuff. And so you might have different tiers of punishment. So if you get caught selling electricity to somebody who is a convicted check kiter, like someone who writes bad checks, okay, not a big deal. If you get caught selling electricity to somebody who kidnapped 16 kids and killed them, well then, holy cow, what are you dealing with that guy for? And then we're going to really punish you for selling electricity to him, because what he did was heinous. Whereas if you get caught dealing with somebody who did a minor thing, we're not going to, we just want to invite you to our birthday parties, but we're not going to punish you. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. You might have these things spelled out so everybody can be on the same page and so that you know beforehand, because you don't want to have to decide this stuff in the spur of the moment. But that's what happened, if you guys remember, when the Julian Assange thing happened, the WikiLeaks, and there were all these different boycotts going on. I mean, it was unclear because we were having these arguments for the first time. And so it was tricky, especially for different groups who might use these products more or less. You know what I mean? Like if somebody used Amazon for everything, he might all of a sudden see the benefit of not punishing Amazon for listening to the government. And so ideally you want to work these rules out. And what are we going to do in this case before it's real? Because it's easier to think through the principles involved when it's not hanging over your head. So Lewis, the point of this is the law can tell you, it's clear if somebody's robbing a bank and he's got a guy who's driving the getaway car. And so the guy goes in the bank, holds them up at gunpoint, takes the bag of gold, jumps in the car, says, go, and they drive away. I think most judges, when the bank brings charges, is going to say that driver is an accomplice. Effectively, he was robbing us too, even though he didn't come onto our property, didn't stick a gun at any of our employees. I think most private legal judges would agree that, yes, that guy is a criminal. But it's not nearly as obvious to say, when then they go and there's the judgment and they're now convicted criminals, and then they go to somebody who sells apples in the street and they walk up to him and give him a gold coin and say, we want to buy 200 apples, and he goes, okay, there you go. It's not clear, is he an accomplice to the bank robbery? Clearly, if he didn't know anything about it, he's not an accomplice. But what if he did know? What if he saw on the news that those guys were convicted bank robbers that were on the run, and he knew full well who they were, and he sold them apples? It's not as obvious, is he a lawbreaker? Okay, and so the thing, the further you get away from this stuff, and especially, that one's a little bit clearer because you could say that's stolen money, but what if they didn't rob a bank? What if instead the one guy just got into a bar fight and killed three people and then hopped in the car and took off? Everyone sees his face plastered on the news, and then he comes up and says to a guy, here, I want to buy some of your apples, and gives him money that he earned from his job. He didn't steal the money, and the guy sells him apples. Did that guy just break the law? It's not obvious that he did. So I'm saying, I think what you're saying is, why do we need to have these other things to supplement it? Because we're talking about going beyond legal titles themselves or property rights. We're talking about people refraining from doing what they have the legal right to do. And so the way you enshrine that and make it a legal obligation is if you sign a contract. So So if everyone circulates this thing saying these are the rules for how we're going to ostracize people, I'm signing my name on this, so now it's a contract. Now I am a lawbreaker if I sell apples to somebody who just is convicted of killing people in a bar fight. Not because in the grand scheme of things it's wrong or it's illegal to do that, but because I signed a contract saying I wouldn't do that. So I'm breaking the contract. That's the issue. Okay. Leonardo's asking me about India as a case study. I just don't know about that. And last question, and then I'll let you guys go because we're a little over time already, is Gordon Clark says, why do vigilantes and bounty hunters have such a lousy reputation? That's a great question. I think except dog. I think part of it is the romanticism of the state, right? So there's just lots of people that think, I mean, it's with the same token, people like professional militaries, and when you talk about having private military defense, people say, oh, you just want to hire mercenaries? When you know, it's not like when it comes to healthcare, if you have people working for wages and salaries that, oh, they're mercenary doctors, or we have mercenary, you know, it's an odd thing where if you're getting paid to do something, that's somehow corrupt, whereas if the government drafts you, then all of a sudden it's great and noble. So I think that's part of it. Just there still is this idea that anytime you do something in the bounds of commerce, it's dirty. And it's just hard to shake that natural knee-jerk reaction that people have. And so especially if it's an area that they traditionally associate with the government providing, to then talk about someone doing it for money is just, ew. And I think that's part of it. Okay, why don't I stop there, guys? I'll see you all next week, or some of you in the office hours. Okay, so long, everybody.